If you speak the truth, have a foot in the stirrup.
Hello, and welcome to another installment of the Sea Realm Podcast. I am your host, KMO, and this is episode number 654. Game over, man! Game over! With guest, well, sort of guest, Chad Hill. Not in voice, he just sent words that I will read to you. But he sent over 5,000 of them, so it's gonna take a while. Alright, to set the stage. I'm imagining that most of you know who Chad Hill is. He is a blogger. He writes a blog called The Hip Crime Vocab. And he's been a guest on the Sea Realm podcast and the Sea Realm Vault podcast I don't know how many times. I mean, he's somebody that I make a point of contacting, you know, once or twice a year to say, hey, let's get online and check in, see what's what. Chad, as you know, you'll be able to tell in the email that I will read, is pretty solidly in the blue tribe. Whereas I am not. I am decidedly Gray Tribe, and I feel more animosity to the Blue Tribe right now than I do to the Red. Even though most of the people that I really get along with and respect and enjoy interacting with are Blue Tribers. And, you know, it's particularly true among the uneducated. I mean, I have zero interest in hanging out with uneducated Red Tribers, particularly uneducated Red Tribe men. Particularly uneducated Red Tribe young men. But even there, there are exceptions. Like Colin over at the TV station, with whom I do videos from time to time, or at least I did before the pandemic. And I could again, it's just that our momentum is broken. I'll say more about my video production work, or lack thereof, at the end of the podcast. But for now, let's just go ahead and get into the first part of Chad's very long email to me. The first part is all about collapse. And as you well know, that was a focus of mine for a very long time. It even spun off a book, Conversations on Collapse, copies of which remain available for anybody who wants them. Dirt cheap. Send me enough to cover postage and I'll be happy to send you a copy. And if you want to get in touch with me about that, send me an email, kmo@crealm.com. Of course, there is a hyphen between the C and the R in Sea Realm. And there's the Sea Realm Podcast discussion group on MeWe. And some of what you're going to hear today comes from that discussion group. All right, but first, here is the email, the first part of the email, the bit about collapse from Chad Hill.
You're listening to the Sea Realm Podcast. C stands for consciousness.
Chad writes, hi, KMO. I have some thoughts and some observations about recent events more generally. I know you like to avoid collapse topics of late. But if what we're seeing around us right now, especially here in the United States, isn't collapse, then what is it? To be perfectly honest, 2020 is turning out to be far worse than I ever imagined things would get in my lifetime. There was once a time when you had to try and convince people that a collapse was coming. Now all you have to do is gesture broadly. It's true that predictions of a dearth of fossil fuels grinding industrial civilization to a sudden halt and plunging it into a pre-industrial world made by hand didn't pan out, and isn't likely to. Instead, a global pandemic has been the catalyst that exposed the cracks in American society that have long been papered over. It's like when a bridge, whose maintenance has been deferred for decades, finally gives way when that overloaded semi-truck drives over it one morning. That semi-truck is called COVID-19. In one of our first conversations, as I recall, we talked about collapse versus catastrophe, with collapse being a long, slow process unfolding over long periods of time, and catastrophe being a sudden, unexpected event that sends shockwaves through the system. The effect of those shockwaves, of course, is determined by how resilient and durable the underlying system is. In America, I'd say that the system is long past its sell-by date. The laundry list should be familiar by now to everyone who's been paying attention. French Revolution levels of inequality, shrinking life expectancies, deaths of despair, epidemic obesity and other chronic health conditions, food deserts, automobile dependency, suburban sprawl, rising levels of depression and anxiety, drug abuse, bankrupt municipalities, crumbling infrastructure, deferred maintenance, fragile supply chains, corporate consolidation, business monopolies, stock bubbles, deunionization, an insular, out-of-touch political class, political corruption, legalized bribery disguised as political donations, voter suppression, boarded-up main streets, shuttered factories, empty storefronts, ghost malls, privatization, unaffordable higher education costs, college debt, expensive childcare, failing urban schools, education quality based on zip code, skyrocketing housing and healthcare costs, financialization and asset stripping, outsourcing and automation, people lacking health insurance, hospitals closing in rural areas, underfunded pensions, unsustainable private debt levels, worker disengagement, a bloated and overextended military, endless, unwinnable foreign wars, veteran suicides, police brutality, street gangs, homelessness, tent cities on the streets, gun violence, school shootings, people living in their cars, hurricanes, floods, and wildfires, mass incarceration, a generation of stagnant working-class wages. The list is so long and extensive that a list of functioning institutions in the United States would be shorter and easier to compile at this point. This week, just a few miles south of where I write these words, an entire downtown has been engulfed in violence and rioting, with buildings burned down and stores looted. Mass protests over the summary execution of a black man by police officers brought out armed militias and vigilantes, many from neighboring states, who openly coordinated their activities with the police. Reactionary political forces are currently circling the wagons to defend a 17-year-old rifle-toting Trump supporter, who came in from out of state and is accused of shooting three people, killing two of them. If the police can't protect us from violence, then anything goes, is their assertion, one embraced by increasing numbers of fearful citizens. At the same time, right-wing paramilitaries clash with protesters in the streets of Portland every night like something directly out of Weimar Germany. It's clear from events over the past few months that there has already been significant radicalization of large segments of the American population outside of urban areas, the full extent of which has been ignored by the media and politicians, and that this radicalization has penetrated not only the formal branches of the military, but also the internal police forces, which are increasingly resembling an occupying army. There are also an increasing number of right-wing militias and paramilitary groups, many of them hotbeds of extremist sentiment and white supremacist ideology. Both they and their ideological opponents see no peaceful means of resolving their differences, and can only recommend their online followers to stockpile ever larger caches of guns and ammunition in a literal arms race. Just this morning, I read the following comment from a user on the financial blog Naked Capitalism. Begin block quote. Longtime lurker, but feel compelled to comment as things are so bad. America is so screwed. I've been following Naked Capitalism since the Great Recession. The trend is ever downward. When people start talking about the need for a new 60s-style protest movement, I have to laugh. How deluded. The police are handing out bottled water to armed right-wing vigilantes and militias. Almost functional fascism. To watch the world hyperpower disintegrating in real time is staggering. Wake up, people. Help is not coming. Look back on this day in a month, a year, a decade. Guaranteed it will get worse. People are getting so crazy. Even regular commenters on this site are saying crazy stuff like, kill them all, referring to Antifa or BLM. WTF? Good luck and take care, everyone. End block quote. I ask you, how can anyone not see this as a collapse? How can any country function under these conditions? Okay, you might say, but there have been riots in America before, from Watts to Rodney King. It's just part of the background noise of American life, you could say. But did these riots unfold alongside the highest unemployment rate since the Great Depression and the greatest single-quarter drop in GDP ever recorded? No, they did not. America's response to the global coronavirus pandemic has caused the rest of the world to stare agape in horror, as if watching a slow-motion car crash. Not only was the response of the so-called leader of the free world to COVID-19 not among the world's most competent, it has been the absolute worst among developed nations, put to shame by countries with a fraction of its GDP. Meanwhile, the world has been treated to the spectacle of Americans angrily marching in the streets and flying into outrage over the simple requirement of wearing a mask, along with a president who denied and then downplayed the very existence of the virus, later promoting untested and unproven cures from behind the podium. Unlike the rest of the world, the virus became a political hot potato in the United States. The United States was unable to effectively contain the virus or implement adequate testing and tracking protocols due to 4 decades of defunding the state in favor of tax cuts for the wealthy and private businesses. Even the slightest directives to help contain the virus were considered an affront to freedom. Many countries ran circles around the United States' pandemic response, including America's past enemies like Germany and Vietnam, both densely populated nations of roughly 83 and 96 million people, respectively. Another commenter to Naked Capitalism noted concerning the U.S.'s COVID-19 response, begin block quote, "The huge problem facing the U.S. and U.K., I think, is that they've floated for decades on the benefits of having excellent administrative structures, while allowing these structures to decay and rot. When you look at how, say, late 19th century cities solved the problems of disease through massive water and waste investments, or waged total war when needed, or built huge highway systems over a matter of a few years, and then compare it to the chaos of today, as you say, it can only make you weep. Fixing it would be a massive effort, and to be honest, I don't see anyone willing to take on that task." End block quote. Despite the greatest economic cataclysm of the post-Depression era, America's politicians went on summer holiday and forestalled any efforts to help individual American workers and small businesses, even while doling out trillions of dollars to well-connected large corporations and the investor class. At the same time, an extra $600 a month was deemed far too generous to the unemployed, encouraging laziness and sloth. As a New York Magazine headline put it, "GOP hopes to revive economy by making life harder for unemployed." One prominent Texas Republican even insisted that the economy must reopen immediately because, quote, "there were more important things than living," close quote, and that he was more than willing to sacrifice his life for the cause. America's outrageously expensive colleges and universities remain shuttered after an abortive attempt at reopening, teetering on the edge of financial ruin, just like its similarly extravagantly wasteful for-profit healthcare system, which leaves millions without coverage even in the midst of a pandemic. 1 million new unemployment claims were filed just last week, and an eviction crisis is looming on the horizon, with politicians sitting on their hands afraid to, quote, "spend too much," close quote. When asked about the revenue shortfalls of cities and states due to the pandemic, the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell callously suggested that they simply declare bankruptcy. Even Marie Antoinette at least offered cake. Also, as I write this, an area larger than some small European countries is burning in California. The fires are raging out of control because the prison labor that is normally used to fight the fires is too sick with COVID-19. Ponder that for a minute. Simultaneously, on the other end of the country, Hurricane Laura is slamming into Louisiana, unleashing devastation across the region. Before it was downgraded to a tropical storm, the Gulf of Mexico was anticipated to get slammed with 2 simultaneous hurricanes back to back, something that has literally never happened before. As one meteorologist remarked, quote, "In modern meteorological history, there's never been anything like this before, where you could have possibly 2 hurricanes hitting within miles of each other over a 48-hour period." Close quote. Okay, but we've had natural disasters before, right? Sure, but it's abundantly clear that they're coming faster and harder than ever now, exactly in line with the most dire predictions of anthropogenic climate change, a problem that, let's face it, we are not going to deal with in any significant way. That ship has sailed. The worst-case scenarios of climate change are going to happen at this point. Anyone who doesn't believe that is living in a fantasy world, in my opinion. Then we have what has been described as a small business apocalypse going on right now across the country. Your erstwhile employer, Amazon, is finally close to accomplishing its long-term goal of consolidating all online commerce under its umbrella, with only a few other behemoths providing any sort of token competition. The consolidation of all commercial activity in the hands of just a few giant global conglomerates, a trend long noted by observers, has, for the most part, been accomplished thanks to COVID-19. Inequality is now surpassing Gilded Age levels. I just heard that protesters are constructing a guillotine outside of one of Jeff Bezos' many mansions. America's billionaires saw their fortunes soar by $434 billion during the pandemic. As Mark Blythe likes to remark, quote, "The Hamptons are not a defensible position," close quote. No wonder they're so afraid of protesters. How can one look around and not see that the country is falling apart in front of our very eyes? And then there's Trump. It's difficult to discuss the administration objectively due to the extreme polarization of American society, itself a cause and symptom of collapse. But I think it's fair to say that the political norms that have kept America relatively stable throughout all of the above challenges are being dismantled by the day. When has a sitting president taken every opportunity to openly cast doubts on the validity of an upcoming presidential election? When has a sitting president contemplated suspending the election outright, even as his cronies dismantle the United States Postal Service, an institution that has literally existed since the Republic was founded? At this point, no one thinks the transfer of power will go smoothly. The only question is, how bad will it get? Think about that. The world's oldest democracy can't even hold functional elections for political office anymore. And that's before we get to the many, many blatant examples of voter disenfranchisement. For example, this spring, I myself was unable to vote because the polling stations in my city went from 180 to just 4 overnight. And attempts to delay the election were deliberately thwarted by the state Republican Party, using the court system, the same court system they are now using to overturn mask requirements. Thanks to gerrymandering, the Republican Party has an ironclad grip on power in my state, and are using it to strip authority from the recently elected Democratic governor. All of it with the tacit approval of much of the electorate. As Nathan Robinson noted in The Guardian, quote, "A failed state is one that can no longer claim legitimacy or perform the government's core function of protecting the people's basic security." Lately, the Wisconsin Supreme Court seems to be doing its level best to make its state qualify for failed status. Multiple decisions have both undermined the government's legitimacy and endangered the people. Close quote. Perhaps the most shocking aspect of the Trump phenomenon is the extent to which his cult-like followers appear to be living in a totally alternative reality, curated by algorithm. One in which COVID is no big deal, the economy is doing great, the police are never wrong, the news is fake, voting fraud is endemic, climate change is a Chinese hoax, homicidal black hordes are pouring out of inner cities, Democratic-run cities and states are all economic basket cases, and the U.S. healthcare system is the best in the world. Democrats want to confiscate all your guns, and the biggest threats to Americans are socialism and cancel culture. And these opinions are as impervious to facts as Captain America's shield is to bullets. How can representative democracy function when there's no longer even a shared common basis in reality? Then we have the QAnon supporters, a bizarre and growing conspiracy movement that is truly living in a separate reality. Energy shortages aside, James Howard Kunstler hit the nail on the head when he noted that, quote, "Sometimes countries just go crazy," close quote. It seems like an apt description of what's going on right now. To steal yet another phrase from Kunstler, even if Biden wins the election and by some miracle there is a peaceful transfer of power, the yeast people will still be there and will inevitably rise again. So, to recap, we are unable to hold free and fair elections, and heavily armed right-wing paramilitaries openly patrol the streets of American cities and occupy state houses with tacit approval from the authorities. Large parts of the country are under de facto one-party rule. The police shoot people with impunity. Cities and states across the country are on the verge of bankruptcy, with the federal government held hostage by a radical conservative movement. Millions are unemployed. This is already below failed state status. Why aren't more people pointing this out? Why aren't people shouting it from the rooftops? The first post I wrote that went viral back in 2012 was called "What if Collapse Happened and Nobody Noticed?" referring mainly to the austerity measures in Europe at the time. Now, here in 2020, I can't help but ask the exact same question again, with even more urgency. How are you people not seeing this? How is any of this okay? Am I taking crazy pills or what? It's as if the 1918 flu pandemic, the Red Scare, the Great Depression, the long hot summer of 1967, Kent State, the Ludlow Massacre, the disputed 2000 election, and Hurricane Katrina all take place within the same 12-month period. At least the massive clouds of locusts are still confined to Africa, for now. Had I said this to you years ago, say, back during the heady days of your so-called doomer phase, you might think that we would all be living in something out of Cormac McCarthy's The Road, and yet it all seems so normal. As I noted, a city a mere 25 miles from where I live was engulfed in riots, yet I only found out about it by going onto the BBC News website. I still go to work. I still walk to the store for some wine, albeit while wearing a mask. I still buy tacos from taco trucks. It is a beautiful, warm, sunny day today with perfect weather. I still have electricity, running water, and internet service in my house. Yet, just a short stroll from where I live, there is a walking path along a river where a large number of homeless people have set up camp. and every off-ramp now features someone holding up a cardboard sign asking for spare change. Oh, did I forget to mention the coin shortage? This is it, KMO. This is what collapse really looks like. By just about any metric aside from maybe screen size and processor speed, the world since 2008 has gotten progressively worse for the average person all over the world. Even the vaunted internet, the subject of so many utopian visions from the late 1990s, has been transformed into either a vehicle for mass surveillance, a vector for the propagation of disinformation and agitprop by hostile state actors, or an echo chamber contributing to the radicalization of malcontents and a way for them to coordinate their activities. And the march of illiberal nationalist authoritarian governments is not confined to the United States. It's a worldwide phenomenon, including places like Brazil, Turkey, Hungary, Poland, the Philippines, Belarus, especially relevant right now, and arguably India, China, and Russia. And that's on top of countries that were never viable democracies in the first place, or are in outright meltdown, like Syria and Iraq. So when I still hear people wondering, when will the collapse occur? I can't help but wonder what reality they are living in, or what the heck they are expecting. It's like someone asking, when will the ballgame start? During the sixth inning. I think it comes from an eschatological background inherited from Christianity, where we are patiently waiting for a single defining event, which will be some sort of turning point. There has always been a quasi-religious aspect to the collapse and survivalist mentalities, which has obscured an accurate appraisal of our situation. As an aside, in my opinion, the notion that I will be okay by disengaging completely from the wider society and somehow living off the grid in a country of 328 million people is a dangerous fantasy, and yet another manifestation of the toxic American concept of rugged individualism, which has gotten us to this point in the first place. It won't work. Any society, no matter how large or small, is an ongoing collective enterprise. We are not Robinson Crusoes all living on our own private island, no matter how many MREs and cases of bottled water we stock up on. The very notion is proof positive that people have pretty much abandoned even trying to constructively reform the system at this point. It's on autopilot. We are powerless, and we know it. It's easier just to give up and withdraw. Defeat is better than disappointment. Even the Silicon Valley tech oligarchs are buying doomsteads in New Zealand because, as Slavoj Žižek once quipped, it's easier to imagine the end of the world than an end to capitalism. So you weren't wrong about collapse, KMO. You were just early and got some of the details wrong. But that's true for most of us. But the collapse is here, and it's happening right now. I don't think that's disputable at this point. We're in for a long, long period of chaos and decline that will probably last for the rest of our lives. After that, it's impossible to tell what will happen. Perhaps the title of one of Buckminster Fuller's books sums it up. Utopia or Oblivion?
On the Sea Realm podcast, a mind that is stretched by a new experience can never go back, to its old dimensions.
All right, we're going to pause there. And I'm not going to say a whole lot just yet. I will just say that the rest of the email doesn't deal with collapse specifically. It shifts gears and, you know, looks at a different topic. But before we get into the second part of Chad's email, I want to share a response from Mark C. Mark is somebody who he's been a guest on the Sea Realm Vault podcast, but his instinct for self-preservation prevents him from appearing here on the main Sea Realm podcast, and I don't blame him. But Mark C., he works at a university in Maine, and he is a regular participant in the very low traffic group, which is the Friends of the Sea Realm. Actually, it's not the Friends of the Sea Realm. It's the Sea Realm podcast discussion group on MeWe.com. So I posted Chad's entire email to that group, and this was Mark C.'s response. Mark C. writes, "You are not crazy. This is the real thing. We are deep into societal and national collapse at this point. I've been having this conversation on MeWe, where I exchange opinions with at most two people, and on a few other sites limited to communists for years. I think it is very likely, a la John Michael Greer's catabolic collapse scenario, that most people won't notice the process. They'll notice the local riots or shortages of stuff that was recently available, and maybe the more extreme political manifestations of late-stage capitalism. Otherwise, not so much. Anything noticeable can be presented and framed by well-situated elites or their professional minions, such that a systemic understanding and analysis is very difficult, or impossible, for most people. That said, some of these situations have happened before, just not in such close proximity, time-wise, or with such a wide range of calamitous happenings, and an international scale. When I lived in L.A. in the late 80s and early 90s, it was just about at the level of a failed state. Racist cops, cops working with gangs, shakedowns by gangs and cops, unsolved murders, riots, and burning buildings, we had it all. We also had, albeit minus internet monopolies, very little real news about any of it. When a situation got to the point of burning buildings, the LA Times did a story or the 6 o'clock news covered it. Otherwise, it might pass entirely unnoticed. I watched a riot in South Central Los Angeles, complete with rioting cops breaking down apartment doors for no obvious reason. Why not, right? Thousands were involved, and it got a short segment of about a minute on the nightly news, and then a few lines in the back pages of the LA Times. All the news was vague on detail. Bad people causing trouble, that sort of thing. One May Day in the early 90s, a contingent of unknown protesters marched through the first floor of the LA Times and trashed it without receiving the slightest mention. Police also didn't bother to stop them. Too much trouble, maybe. The 70s were also pretty violent everywhere, or at least that was the impression I had as a child via the adults around me. We had the Klan and mean-spirited right-wingers on one side and a hodgepodge of leftist rebels whose main focus seemed to be robbing armored bank trucks. Most of the violence on the left was more myth than substance, but a generalized state of potential violence on all fronts was a constant lived reality. Race, religion, just being in the wrong place, any of that could get you trounced or worse. I was regularly trounced for being something or other, and I'm a relatively average white dude. Is the current situation worse or likely to get worse? I don't know, but as a longtime reader of your blog, I value your opinion. The reason I bring this stuff up at all is that people forget how bad things were in the past. I do. I wouldn't remember this stuff if I didn't have written evidence via my own notes and newspaper clippings. Just seems like it couldn't have happened. But I was there for some of it, and yeah, it really was that bad. The reverse is also true. I teach college classes, and students last semester called BS on my claim that when I was in high school, you could have a reasonable life on a convenience store night cashier's pay. A life including a late model used car, weekly entertainment, a decent apartment, and food. They accepted all sorts of other stuff I said, but that one? No way, he's making this up just to get a point across. As bad as Chad's description is, I'm still not sure that it is worse than the recent past, although I fully believe we are heading down the Hershey Highway at a decent clip. If things are going to get precipitously worse, then we really are in for it. I say this because my perception is that there is no left to counterbalance the worst of the right wing. No Communist Party or nation out there, however corrupt they might have been, no real organized opposition at all. As recently as the 90s, there was a small but persistent leftist presence in places where I lived, i.e. Los Angeles and the Central Valley of California and South Korea, usually communist, but with other hard left groups in there as well. They were already long in the tooth and often stubbornly backward-looking, but they weren't to be toyed with. I watched the Progressive Labor Party and a group of anarchists negotiate the release of a prisoner with the South Pasadena Police Department at the end of a demonstration once, and it was an impressive demonstration of power. The PD clearly understood a lot was at stake and was willing to break the law in favor of release. The person in custody had committed multiple misdemeanors and maybe a felony. These parties also had a lot of surprising connections in education, the military, even among cops. As weak as these groups were, I do not believe their equivalent exists anywhere in the U.S. today. And I doubt their existence outside of the U.S. as well. My take is that these groups weren't destroyed by COINTELPRO type operations, although those persist. They fell apart because people, whatever their political inclinations, could generally go to college, have hobbies and entertainment, and get jobs that weren't so oppressive they drove you into the arms of open rebellion. At the same time, real rebellion was increasingly addressed with fast and extreme punishment, such that it was easier and appeared more effective to channel left sentiments into safer forms of expression. I think that's the genesis of identity politics and the sort of feminism that finds Hillary Clinton or Kamala Harris impressive. I guess my first question is whether the right wing, and really all the politics in the U.S. is right of center, will continue the carrot and stick approach now that there is no real left opposition, or whether they will just go for broke. I figure they will continue with carrots and sticks so long as the system is profitable for them. If, as you suggest, we are really, seriously in collapse, though, all bets are off. Why present carrots at all? Where I am, things are relatively normal. My university is handling the situation as you would expect of a well-run establishment, with testing, retesting, tracing, mandatory rules for just about everything, and lots of really detailed scientific explanations for each of the rules and plans. That said, Maine is always sort of a semi-third-world backwater, and we remain so. And things are clearly getting worse. Also, everyone is armed to the teeth and tetchy, albeit so far we've had very little actual violence, and most gun injuries are accidents. Wow, there are a lot of those, though.
You're listening to the Sea Realm Podcast with your host, KMO.
Okay. Now, I will give my own feedback to the first part of Chad's email. Mark started off by assuring Chad, you're not crazy. Chad, you sure sound crazed. I don't think you're crazy. I don't think you have any clinically diagnosable condition, but you do seem to be taking a very alarmist approach to examining the current moment, which, you know, there's a lot of people who resonate with that. And if you're a blogger, before you can communicate anything to anybody, you have to get their attention and hold their attention. So you ask repeatedly, how can anybody see what I'm seeing and not come to the same conclusion that I'm coming to? Now, that's actually a sort of meta paraphrase of what you asked over and over again. What you asked over and over again is, how can anybody see the things I'm describing and not see it as collapse? Well, for example, I'm listening to the audiobook of The Storm Before the Calm, America's Discord, The Coming Crisis of the 2020s, and The Triumph Beyond. And in it, the author, George Friedman, who I know is anathema to some of you out there, those of you who have heard of him, in this book, he is looking at the history of the United States through the lens of two cycles, an 80-year institutional cycle, whereby government institutions tend to encounter crisis and then adapt to that crisis largely by reinventing, you know, by the government reinventing itself or embracing some new paradigm. That happens about once every 80 years. Then there's a socioeconomic cycle that happens about every 50 years. And this is not driven by, you know, the actions of institutions, but by the economy and the evolution of belief systems and identities, you know, national identities, cultural identities, racial identities. And throughout the nearly 300 years of this country being a country and having a government, these two cycles, they overlap, of course, but they have never started and stopped at the same time. And according to George Friedman, the 80-year institutional cycle is coming to an end right around now, maybe a couple years from now. And the 50-year socioeconomic cycle is coming to an end in the early 2030s. And he discusses in the book pretty much everything that Chad addressed in his email. And he says that all of this stuff is going to get worse throughout the 2020s. But then toward the end of the 2020s, there's going to be a new institutional paradigm whereby the rule-governed technocracy and the infrastructure of government, which touches everybody's lives, but which is so impersonal and so inflexible, that will be replaced with a system where people who implement government power, you know, and who represent the government hierarchy at every level will be invested with the ability to exercise common sense. And that this is going to usher in a period of stability and prosperity. Which, of course, you know, will encounter troubles 50 and 80 years down the line, probably sooner than that. But the short answer is, if you see collapse as some sort of finality, some sort of end state, I think it's ridiculous to think that the United States has collapsed, that this is the end state, that we're going to be like this forever. No, this is a period of crisis. You know, if you follow folks like George Friedman, it is a repeating cyclical crisis that we ourselves, you know, will be dead before it comes around again, but it will come around again. But starting in the 2030s, George Friedman, you know, who acknowledges everything in Chad's email, thinks that we are going to enter a new cycle whereby we will enjoy an extended period of calm and prosperity. So that is one way to look at the exact same evidence and come to a different conclusion. To abandon a linear sort of apocalyptic finality and adopt a more cyclical view of how nations and civilizations progress, age, develop, and, dare I say, evolve over time. All right. Now, I mentioned that Chad's email was pretty long, and not all of it had to do with, you know, the big picture sort of state of collapse here in the United States. The second part, well, rather than try to summarize it, here's the conclusion of the email that I received from Chad Hill. Chad continues, switching gears to your conversation with First about gender relations. One topic that didn't come up was the radicalization of many of these disaffected young men to extreme right-wing politics. One would think that if any demographic group would benefit from reforming the current pseudo-meritocratic winner-take-all economic order, it would be them. On the face of it, these young men should be a natural constituency for ideas like reducing extreme income inequality, taxing away enormous multigenerational fortunes, labor unionization, requiring employers to provide decent wages and benefits, subsidized higher education and training for everyone, and establishing things like MMT's jobs guarantee. But they're not doing that. Instead, this demographic appears to be lurching more and more to the extreme right. They are channeling their lack of advancement into these intense hatreds for feminists and political correctness, rather than looking at the underlying economic conditions affecting their lives. Indeed, when one thinks of a stereotypical incel, or NEET, that's N-E-E-T, not in employment, education, or training, one thinks not of the mystical Bernie bro, but rather of a troll on 4chan, shitposting memes in order to own the libs or trigger the snowflakes. What's going on here? It seems that most socially awkward young men, the white ones at least, have been gaslit into supporting a philosophy that is expressly designed to concentrate wealth even more at the top and leave them with even fewer opportunities and a bleaker future than what they have now. They seem driven by some inexorable force to support the economic libertarianism that has destroyed their future. Why is this? Why are they fighting so virulently to defend an economic system that has basically destroyed their lives? Why are they fighting against higher taxes on the wealthy and for stripping away the remains of the welfare state? It's just so bizarre. It's as if the Jews were the Nazis' most fervent supporters. I'm glad that you were willing to take on this charged topic. The lack of discussion surrounding it and the denial that it's even happening are only going to further the radicalization process. I'd be curious to hear First's reaction to this trend. To give a partial answer to my own question, I think one reason is simply that, unlike the left, the right has actively courted this demographic. There is a quote by Steve Bannon to the effect that gamers were his ideal candidates for radicalization. It does appear that there is an active online recruitment effort targeted to computer gamers, many of whom are the young men who have difficulty finding girlfriends or establishing careers. As Vox put it in a 2019 article, quote, "A rot has quietly spread among video gamers, a reactionary political culture from which outright white supremacist groups have been recruiting America's men and boys," close quote. This, of course, does not mean that anyone who enjoys computer games is a budding fascist, if that needs to be said. The popularity of Jordan Peterson provides another example. It's obvious that Jordan Peterson's message is deliberately tailored primarily to struggling young men and boys, although admittedly is not confined to this demographic. Peterson's philosophy centers on reclaiming traditional masculine values and peddles an idiosyncratic metaphysics as the antidote to the chaos unleashed by a creeping cultural Marxism, emanating mainly from college campuses where gays, transsexuals, feminists, and assorted radical leftists reign supreme. Economically, Peterson promotes a form of libertarianism to his fans, or classical English liberalism, as it has been rebranded, while defending the status quo and deliberately conflating social democratic movements and Soviet-style communism. At the same time, hysterical attempts to depict Peterson as a misogynist or even a fascist reflect a deep hostility among some of the more extreme parts of the left to even speaking to this demographic. There is a small but vocal part of the left today that depicts anything remotely related to white males as evil and depicts them as the fountainhead of everything that is wrong with society. This is obviously counterproductive. It's clear that such rhetoric is driving many men into the arms of the reactionary right, but some parts of the left don't seem to care. In fact, they even seem to welcome it. Now, I think the number of leftists who think this way is very small and has been deliberately exaggerated as a rhetorical weapon. but it surely does exist. Another reason might be that these young men have been conditioned to see the welfare state as the root cause of their lack of success with the opposite sex. One frequently hears grumbling from certain quarters online about how women can supposedly have as many children as they want without men because the state is their daddy. This assumes that stripping back the current social demographic welfare state, such as it still exists, will somehow rewind the clock back to a patriarchal system, where women are once again dependent upon males for economic survival. Yet, as you pointed out, the majority of college graduates are now women, and they are seen as more desirable employees by today's corporate culture, for better or worse. These reactionaries are cutting off their nose to spite their face. Women aren't going to go back to being economically subservient without some sort of repressive government straight out of The Handmaid's Tale, which I certainly don't want. Blessed be the fruit. Another factor is that the mainstream left in America is increasingly pitching itself to the winners of this system, the so-called professional managerial class. As Hillary Clinton mused, she won among the, quote, economically dynamic, close quote, regions of the country, the places that were, in her words, quote, optimistic, diverse, dynamic, and moving forward, close quote. Thomas Piketty calls this the Brahmin left, an apt description. If you don't happen to live in one of those optimistic, diverse, and dynamic areas, and have no chance of ever living in them due to the unaffordable housing and education costs which have effectively constructed an invisible moat around them, why then would you feel any sort of affinity for the left's current platform and policy goals? At least you're not walking on eggshells when you tell a coarse joke among your right-wing buddies. The vision of uniting the working classes of all demographics and geographic locations into a coherent pro-worker movement that affects real change is forever sabotaged by this cultural condescension. You've mentioned it many times before. It's frustrating to those of us who want this vision to succeed. It's the vision that was promoted by Bernie Sanders and articulated by shows like Rising, which I believe you are a fan of, as am I. There is no one who is even attempting to speak to the life experiences of those whom Chris Arnaid poignantly referred to as, quote, the people in the back row, close quote, also known as the unnecessariat. And so, without even the hope of a better future, increasing radicalization is unfortunately the probable trajectory for such people. We see it already. We shouldn't have to be this way, but that's the way it is. Hillary Clinton may not have called all Trump supporters deplorables, but the enthusiasm with which they embraced that label to refer to themselves is one of the most telling things from that election, I think. At this moment, I feel so helpless when I see so many young men embracing the toxic politics of the extreme reactionary right, who see those of us fighting for better economic conditions for all of us as the mortal enemies. In some cases, enemies to be slaughtered. And indeed, many factions of the left relish in seeing them as enemies as well, when they should be natural allies. As you noted previously, the right tends to seek out allies, while the left looks for heretics. I don't, of course, and neither do you, but I don't know how we stop this. I guess discussions like this are a start. What brought this vividly to mind is the case of Kyle Rittenhouse, the 17-year-old vigilante who shot and killed several people during the riots in Kenosha this past week. From the reports, he seems to have been obsessed with guns, police, the Blue Lives Matter movement, and was an enthusiastic Trump supporter, even attending his rallies. He seems typical of a lot of these young men. He lived in one of the anonymous down-at-heel areas in the northern Illinois flatland, and was raised by a single mother who appears to have given him the gun and driven him to the protests. So a lack of a father figure, and yes, he probably didn't have a girlfriend either. From my observations, it seems like some form of guard labor is the only option for downwardly mobile whites looking for a decent life nowadays. What does that say about our current economic conditions? It's especially popular among rural whites who tend to be rabid gun enthusiasts. This isn't given enough attention. I work with a number of non-college-educated blue-collar folks, and all of their male sons are in the military, while all of their wives and daughters are nurses or work somewhere in the healthcare industry. They are mostly Trump supporters, although not enthusiastically. When I was young, you might see a security guard only at a bank, if there. Now they are everywhere. Obviously, the more unequal a society is, the more guard labor you need to protect the property of the winners from the burgeoning mass of losers. In this scenario, being a cop means you're not a loser. I wonder if this tweet has a hint of truth. So here's the tweet. These ideas, fascism, authoritarianism, are also aligned with some aspects of the psychology of power and how people react when they perceive themselves to lack power. People often compensate by latching on to ideologies which help them retain a sense of power or explain their feelings of lost power or control. End tweet. Chad continues, I'm going to go ahead and guess that having the power trip of a gun and a badge beats wearing an orange smock and cleaning up aisle 7, which is probably the only other option for a boy like Kyle. Just like it's more exciting and lucrative to inner-city black youth to sell drugs than flipping burgers and manning the deep fryer. But what does it say that these are the best options on the table for so many young men in our country today? What it says to me is that much of America is quietly becoming an open-air prison with two classes of people, guards and laborers. That's a damning indictment of America under late-stage capitalism, of course, but it won't show up in the traditional economic metrics. After all, Dachau had 0% unemployment and reasonably high productivity. Work makes us free. The profiles of his victims are interesting as well. Their profiles are a bit different. They're a tad older, in their 20s and 30s, but still quite young, and both of them apparently did have girlfriends. One had a daughter, and another a stepdaughter. But interestingly, neither appears to have been married. However, none of the reports I've read about them so far mentioned them in connection with any sort of job or profession. The only career mentioned for either of them was skateboarder. Also troubling, but in a different way. So radicalization might be caused by the same underlying economic conditions, but manifesting itself in profoundly different ways. So that's the reality in America today for young men. The skateboarding enthusiast becomes a Black Lives Matter protester, while the gun enthusiast becomes a cop firing tear gas at the Black Lives Matter protester. In the past, small-town guys like Anthony and Kyle might have worked alongside one another for the same company, sent their kids to the same middle school, attended the same church, and played on the same softball team. Now, instead, they're rootless and confused young men sitting on opposite sides of America's increasingly divided society, tragic victims of a country increasingly unraveling at the seams and inevitably spiraling towards civil war. How do we stop this? I wish I knew the answer. So anyway, a lot of thoughts, but no real solutions. In other news, I just recorded a podcast with Christopher Ryan of the Tangentially Speaking podcast. I don't know how articulate I was. I was battling a major case of imposter syndrome the whole time. His podcast topics have quite a lot of affinity with yours, from people living off the grid to psychedelics. I'm going to do my best to suggest you as a guest. Because I've been working partially at home, thanks to the virus, I now have a pretty good teleconferencing setup if you're interested in recording another podcast. Regards, Chad Hill.
You're listening to the Sea Podcast. Your mind, one week at a time.
There's the second part of the email, the conclusion of Chad's email. And this is where I think, Chad, if you are looking to paint a worst-case scenario, really your obvious blue tribe allegiances prevent you from spelling out all that's really going wrong in our society right now, because you take the image of the alt-right, girlfriendless young man, angry young man who's been seduced by the Steve Bannons of the world into supporting extreme far-right politics. Where do you get that impression? So in response to Chad's email, I wrote back to him and said, among other things, I'm not going to read the whole email. I wrote, I just had my 19-year-old son here for a month. A blue checkmarked Twitter user would probably call him an extreme right winger. And that would be absurd. Yes, he disdains some of the more ridiculous ideological demands from the blue checkmark set, but he's not into guns or Blue Lives Matter or anything like that. He followed Jordan Peterson for a while, but I think he's moved on from there. You wrote, quote, indeed, when one thinks of a stereotypical incel or neet, one thinks not of the mythical Bernie bro, but rather a troll on 4chan shitposting memes in order to own the libs or trigger the snowflakes. What's going on here? To which I responded, your characterization of 4chan indicates to me that you don't spend much time on that site. It reminds me of when SJ leftists compile clips of Joe Rogan to demonstrate how problematic and deplorable he is. I don't listen to Joe Rogan regularly, but I tune in for certain guests, and I'm familiar enough with his modus to recognize bad faith attempts at character assassination when I see them. Joe Rogan is habitually humble, recognizes the limitations of his own knowledge and perspective, and defaults to a fair-minded neutrality or at least agnosticism most of the time. He even brings people onto the show that he doesn't agree with and lets them talk without interruption. If you go to 4chan, looking for confirmation of your pre-existing belief that it's a hotbed of proto-fascism, you'll find what you're looking for. But that's like listening to 100 hours of the Joe Rogan Experience to find 3 minutes of out-of-context statements that portray him as a racist, sexist, transphobe, blah, blah, blah. Personally, my problems with 4chan are aesthetic and generational. The formatting of the site is profoundly ugly, and the lack of ongoing identities for the posters renders any sort of reputational appraisal of an offering obsolete. To me, that's a bug, To my son, it's a feature. Generational differences. But for most participants, posting to 4chan isn't about owning the libs. They know that the libs aren't reading 4chan, except to dredge for evidence of Nazi sympathies. There is a community project in progress there that can't be articulated by people who only go in looking for evidence of guilt. Anyway, lots to talk about. To which Chad responded, "You're right, guilty as charged. I don't know much about 4chan beyond the stereotype." So, you invoke a stereotype. You invoke an image of the worst of the young alt-right disaffected youth and accept that that stereotype accurately describes a broad swath of single young men who are disenchanted, disenfranchised, discouraged, dispirited, you know, by the whole dating scene right now. But then you describe the worst of the left that not only doesn't care if young men are driven into the arms of the alt-right, or the extreme right wing, as you describe it, but who actively embrace that, who, you know, understand how damaging it is to demonize young white men, and they go ahead and do it anyway. And then you say that that's a tiny, tiny fraction of the left. That's a tiny little sliver of the blue tribe. Yeah, it might be a tiny sliver, but that tiny sliver has a lot of leverage because they're in the HR departments at the big tech companies. They're the blue checkmark people on Twitter. I mean, basically, Twitter, that is the ideology of official Twitter, you know, of the company, of the platform, and of the users that it chooses to promote and champion. And, you know, I won't go into the all the conspiracy theories or conspiracy facts. I'm not well versed in it, but there is a huge body of literature and discussion and debate over, you know, the supposed neutrality, ideological neutrality of platforms like Twitter and Facebook. You don't have to be some crazy right-wing conspiracy theorist to see a thumb on the scale there. So, from my perspective, you accurately articulate the harmful tactics of the blue tribe, but then you say, oh, this is just a tiny, insignificant little, you know, subgroup. They are tiny, I'll grant you that, but they're not insignificant. They wield power, and they use it destructively. They use it to the destruction and despoilment of this culture, this society, this civilization, this nation. And from my perspective, to pick on the red tribe at this point is to completely lose the plot. It is the blue checkmark Twitter set which the rank and file blue tribe need to reject and ostracize as the, you know, the fanatics that they are. So I talked to First of Incelmatics. He had made a documentary about the black pill, which is basically informed nihilism, is how I would describe it. People who take, you know, an honest look, an informed look at evolutionary psychology, the differing reproductive strategies of women and men, the psychology that, you know, those reproductive strategies give rise to, and then how a corporate workplace which prefers female workers and a dating sphere which is shaped by apps which definitely tilt the tables in favor of women, you know, what effect this has on young men trying to establish themselves as adults with careers and mates and families and the suite of responsibilities and opportunities that give rise to what we used to think of as an adult in the 20th century. And you just appeal to the blue tribe stereotype of, oh, they're all deplorable, ugly, racist, Nazi sympathizers, you know, who have been swept up by the alt-right. Well, I forwarded your email to First, and here's how he responded.
Hey KMO, this is First, and this is my response to Chad Hill's excellent letter to you about collapse and some of the things he touched on gender relations. I've been following Chad Hill and his writing on the hip crime vocab since about 2015 or 2016, so about the same time I found the C-Realm and started following that. And he has some of the most excellent writing I've ever encountered on the internet, and especially his critique of the modern system and specifically the neoliberalism order in the West. So he talks about, in his first paragraph about gender relations, that many young men are, disaffected young men, are kind of attracted to extreme right-wing politics. I've seen exactly the opposite. This is kind of like just mind-boggling to me, because why yesterday we were basically having a conversation in one of the largest Discord servers of the incel kind of community, we were talking about Marxist views on labor. We were discussing, I mean, you will not find a more class conscious group of people than incels and the black pill. They're very class conscious. They're very conscious of their belonging in the kind of social scene. They're, you know, the black pill is not only gender relations, but it's economic, you know, and it's funny that it just, I don't understand where this, I guess on the surface level, you get these ideas that they are on the right wing, but I've seen nothing but the opposite. It's mostly central. It's they're a bunch of centrist and left leaning a lot now, especially when it comes to labor and stuff like that. So it, when it comes to why we, some black pillars or incels detest the far left, it comes to 2012 Occupy Wall Street movements. So what happened is Occupy Wall Street was getting big, and it was all about the working class kind of reacting to the 2008 bailouts during the recession of big business and Wall Street itself. And it seems that this movement got co-opted or infiltrated by kind of this woke type of race, you know, all these things to split the movement up. There's many disaffected men that left that movement, and one young woman too, because all of a sudden there was all these barriers. It was who's about most oppressed, and it seemed like the perfect thing, the perfect wrench to throw at the movement for organized labor in America. I mean, that's the best. You misguide it, and part of this is what we call in the black pill the woke capitalist superstructure. It's about these companies that, hey, we support Black Lives Matter, but you can get evicted, you can lose your job. We're not going to address the job crisis. We're not going to eject that. We're not going to address that. Real wages are going down. The quality of life is going down for workers. They're never going to address that. But hey, we support Black Lives Matter. We support the SJWs, and that's kind of the problem. That's the only problem I've seen. Everyone seems to be aware. Very class conscious, more class conscious than some of the leftist organizations there around Discord or wherever I've seen. Extreme. I mean, that's why we're discussing Marxist theories on labor and three books. I mean, we discussed that way more. And Chad goes into Jordan Peterson and that. And Jordan Peterson and things like PragerU are the most detested things in the black pill community. We detest the traditionalists. We detest the tradcons, as we call them, because they are so out of touch of reality. They are speaking from a perspective that was during the boomer era, from the 1950s to the 1970s, the golden era of increasing wages, where a young man could just get a high school diploma and go have a better quality of life than you know, college educated worker now. It was easy for the boomers, and Jordan Peterson does not represent this movement at all. In fact, these are the most detested figures in the community. We detest, the tradcons because they are just out of sync with the reality of 2020, and they don't address a lot of the labor reality. Again, I've talked to over 1,000 incels at this point through various mediums, and we're a very class conscious group. We understand kind of what's going on in here. Here's the basics of it. It doesn't take, here's a simple, basic one paragraph explanation as to what's happening. There's not going to be pro family policies that we had in the past. I mean, KMO, you talked about Rising, how one of their commentators on the show Rising said that the best policy you could have for America right now is to encourage 30-year-olds to get married. The thing is the elites, you know, at the top with increasing automation for the first time. That's why this and the fourth industrial revolution is so much different, because now an extreme amount of labor is being kind of shifted around to cheaper countries, to globalism, through the sharing economy, which it takes jobs and cuts them into pieces. And just full-on automation that Andrew Yang talks about. This is what we're experiencing. So if the elites have this system that can replace labor, why would they need families to form? Why would they need a man and a woman to get together? That's why this incel crisis, that's why this crisis will never get addressed by the top. Because they don't need it. They need more people to not have kids. Because what happens when they do is those kids have the potential to become disenfranchised labor. Even during when Obama's recovery was going on, there's jobs, we still did not create enough jobs just for the amount of people becoming 18 each year entering the labor force, just for the low, abysmal birth rate we had. So this issue won't get solved because now with oncoming automation and labor is just not worth anything now. It's just tanking. Labor as part of the economy since the 70s the productivity has decoupled from labor. The stock market has completely separated itself from the reality of the economic situation on the ground. So again, this is the main issue. And this is why the gender crisis will never be, because this is a beneficial to the elites. You do not want a bunch of excess labor that's going to go out and riot and protest. That's going to, you know, the Hamptons aren't a defendable position, as Chad points out in the email. And when these riots happen, you know, people at the top, they don't want those to get big. They don't want those to. That's why they introduce, you know, all this cultural and SJW stuff to Occupy Wall Street, because Occupy Wall Street focused on the top 1%, and they needed to subvert that. So, hey, now we got white people going against black people. That's perfect. You know, it's division. And we're seeing the same division in the gender dynamic. And, you know, the whole reason why this won't get addressed and why this will get pushed is because it makes sense for the woke capitalism superstructure that we have is, if you have atomized individuals, they're going to cope with their atomization with spending more money into the economy, with becoming better consumers. The women and the men that are split apart, they have to get their own apartment. They have to get their own furniture. It's just like creating the extended family to the nuclear family. It's an economic boon. It's part of the system. You know, it's to split everything up to individual consumers that can, you know, they. It's not going to be a family, because families produce excess laborers that aren't needed anymore and that are a danger. You know, a labor glut causes a lot of radicalizations that the elites don't want at all. But here's the problem is that the incel, the kind of black pill sphere is centrist. It doesn't really see a solution left or right, because both the left and right don't want to address the sexual reality, the relation, because, you know, here's the thing is now 51% of American men 20 to 29 are single. That's Pew Research that came out very recently. For the first time ever, we haven't seen this much of single males. So the situation is getting worse. More incels are created every day. There's an excess of 10 million young baby boys being born every year. And, you know, here's the difference. Here's the difference in that I will send to KMO as well. You know, single share of U.S. adults who are single varies by demographic group. Among men 18 to 29, 51% single. Among women 18 to 21, 32% single. When you get to 30 to 49, 27% for men, 19% for women. So women are doing much better. And this is not addressed. You know, this, we haven't heard this from any side. This, our frustrations haven't been addressed. And even if you do make it up in the economic kind of sphere, you do climb that hard ladder that's constantly being cut away, you find that there is no result. So when incels see that even if you economically succeed, even though if we have an MMT for jobs or some type of these kind of more egalitarian policies to refranchise labor, it's not going to help them in their most important critical thing they're missing, which is a steady relationship. You know, so they have no motivation to kind of get behind left or the right. You know, they want their issues addressed and they're not being addressed. I mean, men are far likely more than women to be on a dating market. 61% of single men say they are currently looking for a relationship or dates, compared to 38% of single women. You have a biological difference. 80% of women, women, when they were sampled on OkCupid, which is a huge sample size, that it's very statistically valid, they said that 80% of men are not attractive. So even if we do have an egalitarian society, most men will continue to lose out. That's why it necessitates for the female to be disenfranchised in order to for things to work, like it did for the boomers and sort of Gen Xers. You know, the female had to get together with the regular guy to climb the socioeconomic ladder. There wasn't a lot of jobs for women. There wasn't a lot of education opportunities for women. You know, a woman had to basically attach yourself to regular Joe, working at the factory to be able to join the middle or upper classes. And when you don't have that system of incentive, most women drop out. They want nothing to do with most men. And this is clear. I have two-hour documentaries showing this. And to deny this is just insanity. And, you know, I won't say, I know Chad Hill, and he's had issues in the past because of childhood poverty and that he couldn't date and stuff like that. And he's a Gen Xer himself. But I won't say okay boomer to what he says, but it's okay Gen Xer because he's kind of, you know, even though I love his writings, Chad Hill is completely out of touch with the modern reality. Calling incels and black pillars far right when they're more actually left than anything. They're more class conscious than a lot of groups. It's just hilarious to me. Jordan Peterson is detested. PragerU is detested. All these right wing talking heads are detested. So it's not a crazy right wing group at all, and you know, we're just looking for these things to be addressed, because that's going to be the most important. That's on the hierarchy of needs. You cannot start to mobilize incels to really discuss a future for labor when they're so demoralized by a whole gender. You know, basically not having a steady relationship from the work of Dr. Gilmartin, it rots the male brain. It rots any brain. You know, you can't dump your excess cortisol that you keep getting without a steady relationship as a man, without an oxytocin jump once you're in a steady relationship. I've encountered this. Many have reported this, and this is true research that I will send KMO. And this is the problem. It's like we need to address the inequalities in gender, or this whole thing's going to collapse. Because to fix our current society, we're going to need a mobilization like we had back when we had the New Deal. We need a New Deal. But if you have demoralized men, how are you going to get to anywhere? And you know, they're going to continue to be demoralized unless we address the realities between the gender. We're addressing the realities between race, reality between class, all this, but gender, nah, we don't touch about it. And if we do touch about it, it's denied. Statistics are outrightly denied. More men than ever are now single. More men than ever have no relationship potential, are completely social isolated for most women. You know, and women aren't, there's barely any women stepping up and talking about this at all. You know, and it's going to cause infinite frustration. And until this is really discussed, until why can't we have an honest conversation about gender dynamics in this country, the real ones backed up by real statistics and data, until we have that, get ready for more Kyle Rittenhouses, because they're going to get either radicalized by the left or right. And you know, they have, you know, if these men had steady relationships, I know that there's some outliers and, you know, okay, these guys had, but most, you know, 51% of American men are single, and people wonder why we have such social instability now. It's not a good system to have. It's not a good system, especially when it rots the male brain to become more like the warrior gene. That's what excess cortisol does without dump in oxytocin. You know, that's what the research shows. So that's why men are going to get more violent, men are going to get more frustrated, men are going to get more extreme. You know, the future is a lot of Kyle Rittenhouses, and not addressing this is going to be the downfall of any civilization, because you will not mobilize half a gender to address any issues that we have on the collapse. So that's the problem.
There's first, there's his perspective. You know, you invoked the stereotype of the angry young man disenfranchised from the dating market and also pushed to the fringes ideologically by bad behavior on the left, and also by, you know, an invitation from the right. You took that stereotype as real, but here's some feedback from First, who, you know, his information is not based on stereotypes. It is based on hundreds of conversations that he has had with other young men in this position. And they are a very class conscious bunch, according to First. The, you know, absolute opposite of the stereotype that you invoked. What will you do with the stereotype now? Will you reappraise it? Or will you ignore this evidence, which runs contrary to it, and just continue to accept, you know, the blue tribe presentation of the deplorables? The young men, many of them in the economically depressed parts of the country, you know, the middle of the country, the flyover country, and say, yeah, it's kind of a shame that, you know, these people could be our allies, but we're not making any real efforts, you know, to bring them in and actually engage with them. Find out what their interests are. And, you know, now that you have been given some information that this really is a very class conscious bunch of people, what will you do with that information? How will you change the message that you articulate on your blog to incorporate this more nuanced understanding of the category of people that you dealt with a very convenient stereotype, convenient for the blue tribe? You know, you said that not everybody who enjoys video games is a proto-fascist, and that probably shouldn't be said. And yet you said it right around the same place where you were quoting Vox. And Vox, I mean, that is the official line at Vox. That gamers are deplorable. Gamers, young men, you know, who compensate for their lack of social achievement through video games, you know, through simulated experiences of reproductive success, you might say. Defeating enemies, gaining the rewards for your bravery. Now that you've heard from First on this, the next time you encounter somebody peddling that same blue tribe dismissal of young men, that they're all deplorable, that they are all proto-fascist, that they hate women, are you going to push back against that? I hope that you will. All right, I'm going to leave it here for now. This is an episode of the C-Realm podcast. On the next free episode, I hope to have Chad here for a one-on-one conversation. But for the long-suffering C-Realm Vault subscribers, I am taking a little break from the audiobook production, but my reading of Donald J. Putin on American Exceptionalism, It's Not You, It's Just America Being America, will continue on the next, not the next episode, but the after that, the episode after next of the C-Realm Vault podcast. On the next C-Realm Vault podcast, I have a conversation with Jim, your ad attacker of the Attack Ads podcast. He lives in Seattle, which, you know, has seen some action recently. And we talk about, you know, just in general terms, the big picture of what's happening right now. So that will be on the next episode of the C-Realm Vault podcast. All right. And also, I'm doing a 2-hour live stream every day now, every weekday, Monday through Friday, from 9 to 11 a.m. Eastern, in which I'm just drawing. You know, you will see what's on my Cintiq, basically. You'll see the drawing that emerges as I make it. And if you want to ask me questions in the chat, I will be happy to answer them by voice. So you'll hear me speaking. I will see your typed messages. So this stream is through Picarto.tv. Picarto.tv. And my login there, or, you know, my channel there is KMO Art. So KMO is in all caps and ART is in lowercase. I would love to see some familiar names in the chat and have people ask me questions so that I can keep jabbering the whole time, the whole 2 hours as I'm drawing. Think of it as a live stream. It's something which I think is important for people in my line of work, you know, digital content creators to do these days, and I am late to the live stream game. So if you would, please help me catch up by following me there, participating, giving me something to talk about. And you can also make suggestions on things for me to draw. All right, and finally, my YouTube production has fallen off a cliff as of late. Partially, it's because I had my kids here, first my youngest son, then my older son, for about 2 months total over the course of the summer. But also, the past couple of weeks, I have been really caught up in chatting with Filipinas via Filipino Cupid and WhatsApp. So I joined the dating site, Filipino Cupid, and I had the exact opposite experience of what First described for men on American dating sites. I was the sought after property. I, you know, was inundated with attention, and I couldn't help it. I had to behave the way that, you know, First and the incels describe women as behaving on dating sites here in the States. There was too much interest for me to respond to everybody individually. So most of the women who wrote to me got all of nothing in return, you know, silence, crickets. And, you know, because I couldn't pursue, and I pursued conversations with, I don't know, 30 people. I mean, I spent a lot of time, many hours every day, communicating with different people. I sometimes fell into a sort of interviewer role where I was really just, I was not exploring a relationship with them. I was sort of drawing their story out of them, which I realize isn't why they were on the site, and which is not really fair, because as First and, you know, the incels say, in the American context, women, while they're getting attention via the app, they are getting what they want right there at that level, whereas the men are seeking something more. Well, on Filipino Cupid, it's the reverse, at least for me. I was getting validation. I was getting a reward just from the online conversation. And for me, it didn't need to go any further than that to be valuable. Whereas for, you know, a lot of the women that I was talking to, they wanted to move immediately. They wanted a change in their situation right now, and I couldn't offer it. So even though my paid month isn't up yet, I have hidden my membership profile so nobody else sees it. And really, I won't say anything about her because she's very shy, but my communication is basically down to one person who I talk to on voice calls and video calls a couple times a day, every day. So, again, I'm getting a lot out of it just on the online level. And while I would, with this particular person, very much like to move it into the real world, that's not going to happen anytime soon. So there's a long story there that here on the free podcast, I've said as much as I'm going to. Although Seabrown Vault subscribers and people who support me at just the $1 level on Patreon get videos where I tell a bit more about what's going on the whole Filipino Cupid front. And I will be making a free video on that topic in the coming weeks. So to see that, tune into my YouTube channel. It's Out of My Head. And if you can't find it on YouTube, I hate to say this, but it's still the case. If you want to find me, type in Human Suck and maybe throw in KMO as well. And you'll find one of my videos, one of my early videos, which will get you to the channel where you can find the more recent stuff. Of which I say there isn't a whole lot because, well, I've had a delightful distraction keeping me from directing my full attention to creative productivity here in recent weeks. But as you can probably tell from my tone of voice, I don't regret it. All right, everybody, I am, well, turning my attention to editing now, but then after that, I will be turning my attention to combing through that conversation with Jim, your ad attacker of the Attack Ads podcast, and I'm going to pull out a few snippets to throw into the next free episode, because I know most people here are not going to subscribe to the vault and hear, you know, the subscriber-only content, and there's some really good stuff in this conversation with Jim, so I'll pull out some of the highlights and give it to you on next week's episode, or the next episode of the Seabrown podcast. I can't promise it'll be out in a week's time. All right, that is all. You know, I've been saying for years, my formulaic close is stay well, but here in 2020... Wow. Let me say it with full intention and consciousness, and I really mean it, and I hope that you can follow this advice. Sea Realm subscribers, Sea Realm podcast listeners, friends of the Sea Realm, friends of mine, people I know and care about, please stay well. Take care of yourselves. I will talk to you again soon.